Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to my Blog Talk Radio show, Live Your Music. I'm Margot Joy Donator, and I'm broadcasting from Marin County, California. My guest for today's show is Merle Saunders, Jr. Music is a birthright for San Francisco native Merle Saunders, Jr. Merle, the namesake of legendary keyboardist Merle Saunders, grew up in the heart of the Bay Area music scene with other well-known music families like the Grateful Dead, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and the Gospel Hawkins family. From his first tour with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band to subsequent gigs with Michael Jackson, Robert Cray, David Crosby, and Frank Zappa, Merle developed a unique ability to excel in the music business. As Director of Marketing and Artist Relations at Gibson Guitars, and as Senior Marketing Coordinator and Artist Relations with Dean Markley Strings, he led creative teams to produce successful campaigns and endorsements for many top Grammy winners. In 1994, Merle produced Gibson's 100th anniversary celebration. Pulling together talent, Merle brought to stage Country Joe and the Fish, Little Feet, Greg Allman, Elvin Bishop, Hot Tuna, Moby Grape, and Bob Weir, as well as his dad, Merle Sr. In July 2000, Merle was named Executive Director of the San Francisco chapter of the Recording Academy. His mission was to help promote music and arts education. Under his leadership, the chapter realized a 10% increase in membership annually and achieved a greater audience for the music business. In early 2013, Phoenix Supper Club opened in San Rafael, California, and Merle was named Executive Director of Phoenix Entertainment Group. Merle's objective, along with Phoenix owner Laura Van Galen, is to expand the Bay Area music scene by creating a state-of-the-art venue for live performances, along with the technology to record and share music by streaming it to the world. To find out more about Merle Saunders Jr. and Phoenix Supper Club, you can visit the Phoenix website at www.phoenixlive.com. That's phoenixlive.com. Welcome, Merle.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
I am so happy to have you on my show because of all the people I know, you are one of the ones that is most living your music and have had a life that revolves around music. And even though live your music means to do what you feel inspired to do, in other words, it doesn't have to be just music, you're doing what you feel inspired to do, and your music is music, real live music. So I wanted to start out with talking about how we met, which was in Toastmasters here in Mill Valley, and about some of the stories that you told us about growing up with your dad and what it was like. And I remember one specifically where you were talking about Joni Mitchell and the song Both Sides Now. So what was it like growing up with all these people that your dad introduced you to?
Well, I think the experience is like most children. I think at a certain point you realize your parents' friends are in the public eye. I think as a child, people are just people that come to your house. You have no idea who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And if you regularly see your father's friends on TV or go see them perform, that's just, it's a norm. And you don't really think of that. And you don't put it in context of everybody else's parents don't do this.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until I was an early teen and, you know, the peer group recognized people who I had grown up with as, I don't know, whatever you want to call them, or people they actually recognized or knew.
Mm-hmm.
And it took on a different meaning, you know, going through school as a teen. But other than that, it's just, you know, being around creative people, you know, allowed different experiences. And I think you get a greater insight into the creative world as a kid. And, you know, you're around people that sort of achieve their dreams or have always gone after their dreams. So kind of inspires you that there's no door in front of you that you can't open or no wall you can't climb over.
Oh, I love that. No door you can't open and no wall you can't climb over. That's fantastic. Wow. So tell me a little bit about some of the people that you did meet through your dad and through his music, starting with, I guess, with your teens then.
Well, it's, you know, the normal thing. Most people associate him with the Grateful Dead and Jerry Garcia. And at one instance, I had a science fiction class in junior high school, and being able to tap into an artist that his passion was science fiction and also sort of understanding sort of the culture in San Francisco in the early 70s and what was there creatively and being able to tap on that. So writing a science fiction, you know, story for school and, you know, sitting at the dining room table and have Garcia comment on what you're writing or any of the other folks, you know, the writer Thomas Wolfe and, you know, various other creative folks. Mm-hmm. I think it just gives you an insight. And once again, it's like when you have people who are at the top of their game, sort of not so much tutoring you, but, you know, allowing you to sort of follow where your path is going. It's like having these people sprinkled through your life. I think it just helps. It helps the experience of growing up, because on top of just having, you know, having one parent tell you, you've got all these creative people who've lived these, you know, amazing lives. Mm-hmm. Chiming in with their experiences too.
That must have been really incredible. And most of us didn't grow up in those kind of environments where we had people showing us and telling us that anything was possible, and that you know, to live your music, in other words, to live what you feel inspired to do and to believe in yourself, and then to get a guide or guides that can help you, and then start practicing and be willing to make mistakes, you know, the whole thing. So that to me would be just amazing. So what happened next? What did you do next? When did you start going on tour with the band?
The first time I did a solo tour, I was probably in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And that was, once again, I had grown up with a lot of people, and I think it was a novelty for people to have me work for them, knowing that they had known me most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
The Hawkins family, Edwin Hawkins singers, had known me most of my life.
Mm-hmm.
Crosby, Stills, Nash, David Crosby, I had known since I was a really young person. So it's kind of a novelty for them to hire me to work with them. It's sort of like, with them, it's like having your nephew work with you kind of thing. And, you know, it's, you sort
and for
of
you,
live
it must
and learn.
Have felt, yeah, and for you, it must have felt comfortable also, like you were part of the family and you were working
you
with
know,
family members.
Yes and no. I mean, it's all part of the growth period. As a young person, I think understanding what an opportunity was and, you know, people giving you the opportunity to grow as a person, both professionally and emotionally. That was kind of, you know, it's kind of like a safety net of traveling the world with people that kind of cared about you versus it was just a job.
So how did it go from that to you touring with Michael Jackson? Is that a
that's
big
all,
jump?
It's an evolution. It's all an evolution, and it's mm-hmm. all, like most jobs, right place, right time, mm-hmm. having the right amount of skills to fulfill, you know, a position that's open. The Michael job came at a point where I actually got the job. I called a friend to say, you know, congrats on getting the tour. And mm-hmm. he said, there's another slot open. And the next day I was on a plane down to L.A. meeting the production team. And
mm-hmm.
A day later, I was packing for a couple of years. I was hired sort of on the spot, and that started the journey. And that's kind of like the progress in doing touring like that is you get hired on your reputation, and you get hired because you kind of fit into what's going on.
So how did you say 2 years, that the tour was 2 years?
That tour was 2 years. Most tours were, they're for a set length, but, you know, that one lasted, it was 2 years to do the world.
Wow. So what was it like going to that many Michael Jackson performances?
Like any other performance. I mean, it's a job. There's virtually, you know, you have a script on what you have to do all the time during the show, and there's more downtime than there's performances, and depends on what act you work with. Michael was an act that worked no more than 4 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just as much as he did. Subsequent to Michael, I left and went and worked with Frank Zappa, and Frank worked 5 to 6 shows a week.
Mm.
And the same thing for an 8-month tour. And it's all based on the act and how much they really want to perform. And as a supporting person working for them, you kind of just do what needs to be done.
It's just so hard to imagine from this side of it, of not being a part of the music industry in that way, and just to see it from the performance side, where you see the performance happening, and that there's so many people that are behind the scenes that make it all happen.
The fun part of it. It's being a part of a production where, you know, like I said, most people don't know that when you go to a larger show, it's anywhere from 50 to a couple hundred people. To make that hour and a half on stage magic happen.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, so then from there you went to Gibson Guitars, and then to the Grammys. So how did that come about?
It's the same thing, right? I had did a stint with Gibson Guitars, and I worked for Dean Markley Strings, and it was, and touring, I basically dealt with the same people all the time. The constituency are the musicians. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, you're around long enough, you build up friendships, you get to know people, you do that. And getting to the Grammys was another one of those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
They hired me, and I was one of the few people that I didn't really know a lot of the managers, but I knew all the musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, and as the Grammys, their commodity are the music people. So being able to connect and being a music person, and one of their goals is music and arts education, and sort of promoting it through and to the community you live in, it's an extension of everything else.
It was an extension of everything you grew up doing and believing in and enjoying, right?
Yes, it was, you know, it's what came natural. It's you know, you live long enough, you can become a teacher, kind of thing.
Right, and also at that point, because of the evolution of your career, it was what felt like the next step, right? It didn't feel like, oh my gosh, the Grammys. It was, oh, the Grammys.
It was another chapter in life.
Right,
and yes, it was a professional, I don't really want to say goal, it was a professional achievement, and working there, and it was, you know, you get in your job, you learn your craft, and you do what you do, and, you know, there are companies out there that, you know, you're hired because of what you bring to the table, and it was one of those organizations that you got on a lot of bases. On top of dealing with the professional musicians, there is a whole part about arts education. So part of it was giving back to the community and mentoring and teaching young performers. And there was a whole student component where we went into high schools. And that was, it was as rewarding as the show itself, of being able to see, you know, you're planting the seeds for kids in junior high and high school. And over the course of 10 years, there were some kids that were part of the programs that eventually were on the show in different bands.
Oh, gosh, that sounds like that could be a whole show in itself, talking to you about that.
So there's that part of planting the seed in some kid that's, you know, 14 years old, and 8 or 9 years later, they've polished their craft, and they're in a band that's on the show.
Well, so how long were you with the Grammys then? With
just about 10 years.
Hmm?
10 years.
10 years?
Yeah.
And so that took you into what you're doing now. And so how did that come about, that you became part of the Phoenix Entertainment Group? How did that all start?
It's fortuitous and everything else. I met what eventually became the partner, and she came to me with a concept, and the idea was to sort of rejuvenate a music community that was thriving a lot of years ago, and through time, technology, and everything else, the music business was kind of disjointed. There weren't places to play, and one of the things was being able to bring music to people, a certain level of music to people via the web, their handheld devices.
Mm-hmm.
So we built a facility that could broadcast and capture all the performances that we did. And with the help of a lot of people along the way, people that I had known most of my life, and the gentleman that eventually became the partner in building the places, it's Walter Stork Design Group. This guy, John Stork, who was sort of an amazing acoustic designer.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also with the help of an old friend, John Myers from Myers Sound.
Mm-hmm.
And a group of folks who I had toured with, you know, everybody had their little input. I sort of went to everybody. And and what you see is the facility now. And it's the input of a lot of people. You know, I asked lots of questions on every aspect, on how to create the perfect environment for a musician to come in and us, and we as a company capturing it and presenting it to the world.
That is just so amazing. And for the people that are listening on perhaps on an iPad or other type of device like that, there are photos that you can see if you go to this same radio show online and click on it. I've got pictures of Merle and pictures of Phoenix Live, and the link for the website's right there also. So people will be able to take a look at it all. And it is such a beautiful place, Merle. And I mean that in all ways. It's beautiful to look at. It's beautiful music. It's beautiful people. It's so much love went into designing and building that place. It's just amazing.
Well, it's a place of, it's providing opportunity, and it's a place for the creative world, both professional and the young up and coming. We try and do shows where we have high school bands play, and it's an all ages stage, and we get, the local kids who shine are able to come in there and do shows, and it's a great experience for everybody, both the musicians and the patrons and, you know, folks who just like the arts.
And then also, we started going to Phoenix because we knew you, and so we really liked it, and we always bring people when they come from out of town, whether it's our son or my sisters or friends from out of town. We always bring them there because it's our favorite place to show them and also to hear music, and it's just an amazing place. But the other thing that is really cool is that the West Coast Songwriters is meeting on the third Tuesday of every month at Phoenix as well, and through a bunch of coincidences, not even through you, actually.
It is actually through me. The West Coast Songwriters, why they're there.
Well, that's true, but what I'm saying is how we met Robert Crane and Laura Lee Brown was a set of coincidences that we had a postcard on the counter in our kitchen, and my sister Tina was visiting, and she happened to pick up the postcard, and she said, "Oh, look, they're having an Earth Day celebration over at Redwood High School and doing a songwriting contest for West Coast songwriters, and we hadn't even read the postcard. And so Tina and I talked Dudley into entering his song Earth Blues. Didn't win, but we went over to Redwood High School, which is where Xander went to high school, for the celebration, met Robert Crane and Laura Lee Brown, and they invited us to come as guests. And then we ended up deciding to join. But it's just so wonderful having that whole tribe of people that love music that are so willing to share what they've learned and to encourage the newer people. It's just amazing. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great organization. In Crombie, I have been invited, been involved with the organization working for the Academy, the Recording Academy, where I did their annual conference, and Ian was on our board, and it's just through a relationship and seeing what they do, it sort of mirrored a lot of what the Phoenix was about, so it was a no-brainer to have them in there, sort of promoting up-and-coming musicians.
Yeah, well, it's definitely a lot of fun, and we really, really enjoy it. And the other thing is that you have a recording studio upstairs where you do the live streaming from, and you also record musicians up there. Is that correct?
Well, part of the whole production suite for us is, yeah, we're able to multi-track in HD, and there's an HD. We record in HD video and for audio, so we can, we're able to capture everything at the sort of state-of-the-art level and produce shows and produce videos for bands that, it's state-of-the-art, and they use it for, you know, their promotion or whatever, and we, our dark days, we actually rent out our facility, and bands come in and shoot videos, and it's a great all-around place. It's not only is it a place to come and experience the Phoenix of having dinner and watching a show and being a part of the community, but for the musician side, they can come and they can use it just like a studio on the dark days.
That is so cool. And the time is just flying by like I knew it would. And so I want to mention that next week on October 8th, my guest will be Alex Woodard. And Alex is a singer, songwriter, musician, and author of two inspiring books titled For the Sender. And we'll be talking about both books and the songs that are included with each book. Each book has a CD with it during the show. And I'll be posting the link for the show on my Facebook and Twitter, and also people can sign up for my e-newsletters at margojoydenader.com. Oh, Merle, you know, I don't know if you've ever heard of Alex Woodard, have you?
No, I haven't.
No, he's not been in the music business anywhere near as long as you, but he is a Hay House author, and that's how I found out about him, was through Hay House Publishing. They published his first book, which is called For the Sender. He wrote letters, or a woman wrote him a letter, that's how it started, about losing her husband or boyfriend. I can't remember if they were married, it doesn't matter, but I mean, to me, to the story right now, it matters to her. But he wrote a beautiful song called For the Sender, and it's just amazing how the whole thing worked out. He was originally a struggling musician trying to get gigs, not having things working out. And once he started doing this where it was to help other people, and he started collaborating with other musicians and singers and songwriters and realizing that it wasn't just him that would sing it, that's when it started getting more and more popular. So it'll be really interesting talking with him next week. And back to you. What music do you hear calling you now? What's calling you next?
What do I listen to? Well, it's like most music in my life, and it's like how most people find music. There are things nowadays there is, I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people that you know, you can listen to music on the services. You know, you can go to Spotify, you can go to Pandora.
Mm-hmm.
You can do all that. The old CD baby, if you really want to buy CDs. I listen to things, you know, certain songs, certain artists sort of capture me, and that's all over the board. I mean, I listen to classical, I listen to folk, I listen to rock, I listen to R&B and soul. What's in my iPod, or what's in my iPhone, I tend to go back to the classic stuff. I mean, I listen to a lot of sort of 70s, 60s, 70s. I'm in the Stevie Wonder phase of going through his talking
Stevie Wonder is, oh my gosh, he's amazing.
That's it. I know. I also listen to sort of classic, or not classic, but traditional jazz. I will still go back and listen to Miles Davis, Kind of Blue. This morning on my workout, you know, there was Giant Steps from John Coltrane. There was Joni Mitchell songs. There's Pat Metheny songs. There's Luther Vandross. You know, good music is good music. It transcends any genre.
Mm.
And kind of, that's kind of how I listen to music. You know, it's more of, if it's good, it's good. And it shouldn't be defined by a genre. I can listen to, let's see, The Way by The Band. I can listen to Jolene by Emmylou Harris or Dolly Parton. I can listen to a Quincy Jones song. I can listen to, you know, some of the pop stuff that's out now. And it's all, what's good is good for me.
You know, that's what our friend Robert Berry, who owns Soundtech Studios, says. He's grown up with music his whole life as well, and in a different way, very different way. But he's always said that he likes all kinds of music, except for maybe he's not real big on opera. But as long as it's really well done, you know, and so even that probably, as long as it was well done. But that's the point, is, you know, that people play and sing what comes from their heart, and I think that translates.
And that's the way, you know, that's the way listeners do it. It's what you listen to. You know, I can listen to opera. I can listen to Leontine Price or Frederica von Stott sing something, and mm-hmm. it's just as poignant as listening to a classic R&B song or a classic rock song. All good.
Well, I think that the thing about opera is that unless you've grown up around it or been exposed to it, and I haven't, and I imagine Robert probably hasn't either, I think that there's probably getting used to it and understanding it, and probably if we were to do that, we would.
Well, what most people, here's the one thing most people don't know about me. Here's the takeaway. So I actually started, I played a
what
lot of instruments. But I actually sang classical music. That's what I actually studied. So
classical music?
So that's actually what I studied, and it's the only time I've ever performed has been classical music.
And what do you mean by classical music exactly, so our audience knows?
I sang opera, I sang choral music, I was a part of that whole scene growing up. And that was my performance days.
That's fantastic. Oh, Merle.
It's kind of like the root of where most of the music started. It's all music that's 400 years old, or what we considered Western European music.
Yeah. Well, I wish we had a lot more time, but we only have a few seconds left. So I want to thank you again for being on my show, and I want to remind all of my listeners to listen to your heart and live your music, because when you live your music, everybody benefits. Merle, thank you again for being on my show and for you and Laura and the Phoenix and for everything.
Thank you kindly, and have a good day. Have a great day.
Oh, thank you. Bye for now, everyone. Live your music.